This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
Fleet Admiral Ernest J. King. That's really the best way to sum up this next 45 minutes. And with us is Dr. David Conan, retired commander, Navy Reserve. He is also director of the Hattendorf Historical Center at the Naval War College and is executive director of the Naval War College Museum. Dave, thanks for coming on to Preble Hall.
Hey, Claude, it's always good to talk.
Yeah, it's. I'll tell you, it'd be a lot better if you were down here in Annapolis, but you know, you're. It's nice that you're in the junior school up there. So, all right, I'm going to ask you a very simple question, but also a very difficult question, because you've done a lot of research and writing on Ernest J. King. In one or two sentences, sum up why people should know the significance of Fleet Admiral Ernest J. King.
It starts with the title. You know, Fleet Admiral is a rarefied rank in the history of the United States Navy. King is among the Fleet Admirals of the Second World War. Five-star rank. George Dewey arguably held a higher rank, but George Dewey did not fight in a global war involving multinational coalitions, personalities like Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt. Figuring out how to synchronize global operations on a scale that remains unprecedented into the 21st century. And that's why I believe Fleet Admiral Ernest J. King really provides the model by which any strategic thinker should think about global maritime strategy, not only in wartime, but also in peace. King, in fact, spoke about the role of the Navy as being unlimited, whether in peace or war. So if you build a warship, you can use that warship to provide humanitarian assistance in peacetime, or you can use that warship to do the nation's business in the event that an enemy chooses to fight.
Did he come from a Navy family?
Ernest King came from a naval family, arguably, maybe more a sailor type of family. His father was Scottish, of course, and emigrated to the United States and settled on the shores of Lake Erie in Lorain, Ohio. And King actually worked in the shipyard and in the railroad facilities that his father worked in as a youth. And I really think of Ernest King as a sort of a working class hero from the Midwest who found his way in the ranks of our great Navy. And the one thing I would say about his upbringing in Lorain, Ohio, is he used to hang around with the Civil War veterans. And he was really influenced by early on as a young man in Lorain, Ohio. He was early on influenced by those veterans telling sort of sea stories about their service in the Union ranks of the Civil War. His uncle, in fact, was an artillery officer. So early on, I think King was sort of hardwired to think about a career in the military services. And in the end, he ended up embracing the traditions and sort of briny culture of the Navy. And if I can channel my inner King, he would immediately tell us that the naval service is not actually a military service. It's a naval service, which is oriented towards the oceanic domain, which happens to be the largest piece of geography on planet Earth.
Why did he go to the Naval Academy?
So King went to the Naval Academy after he dropped out of high school. His father basically said, hey, if you drop out of high school, you're going to go to work. And that's where he ended up going. And eventually King decided to go back, and he ended up as the valedictorian of his high school class. The speech that he delivered as the valedictorian was actually called The Uses of Diversity. What's great about that is here's a high school kid about to go on and seek a career, and he's talking about the uses of adversity. And he's inspired to talk about the adversity that he experienced himself in his youth, not only working with his father in the shipyard and the railroad repair facilities in Lorraine, but also he lost a sister to tuberculosis. His mother died of tuberculosis. The family was a relatively large but middle class family, so money was always an issue. And King, I think, was tempered by that upbringing, and you see that reflected in the way he carried himself in the ranks of the United States Navy as he came up through the ranks.
What do we know about his experiences as a midshipman at the Naval Academy?
His experience at the Naval Academy is, I guess, pretty typical of that of a naval cadet, as they used to call him back in his day. He had a lot of friends. He was very popular in his class. He did have a rivalry that lasted an entire career with Adolphus Andrews. And Adolphus Andrews and Ernest King just did not get along, because both of them were trying to be the very best. They were in a race to the top ranks of the Navy throughout their careers. And that is reflected in the correspondence between the two. It's rather unfortunate, because I think that if Ernest King and Adolphus Andrews could have figured out a way to get along, I think the two of them could have made a pretty potent team. The problem was that Adolphus Andrews came off sort of he had an air of superiority about him. He was a card-carrying member of what they used to call the Gun Club. And Ernest King, of course, abandoned the Gun Club early on after he'd done some service in the Asiatic Fleet, and ended up, sort of doing his own thing in the ranks of the Navy all throughout his career. And Adolphus Andrews pretty much followed the standard path of a battleship sailor. So there's a bit of tension between the two personalities that does manifest itself during their careers. And then, of course, during the Second World War, Adolphus Andrews was the commander of the Eastern Sea Frontier. And, he tried to take over anti-submarine operations early on in 1942, just at a time when the Navy Department was in complete disarray after the Pearl Harbor episode. And one of the big mistakes that Adolphus Andrews made, at least from King's point of view, was that Adolphus Andrews kept trying to micromanage everything and sent out message traffic to skippers telling them what course and speed to follow. And when King was made the Comanche in December of 1941, he read the message that Andrews had put out and said to Admiral Andrews, do not presume that you were on the bridge of every ship at sea, unquote. Which is pretty good stuff. It basically is telling Adolphus Andrews to stop micromanaging. And I suspect if we were to bring King back today, he might have something to say about micromanagement in the 21st century Navy as well.
You had mentioned that King was critical of the curriculum at the Naval Academy. Was that reflective, or was that while he was there at the Academy?
So after he graduated from the Naval Academy, King developed a really deep interest in understanding the broader perspective. And the Naval Academy curriculum was really focused on engineering and science and mathematics. And there's a great quote in his memoir, Fleet Admiral King, where he talked about the culture at the Naval Academy, where a midshipman would literally stand at the chalkboard chewing on his chalk just so he could get the answer correct every time. And King's main criticism of the Naval Academy curriculum was that it emphasized rote memory as opposed to actual understanding. Later on, he told his biographer, Walter Muir Whitehill, that his education at the Naval Academy was, quote, defective. And so Ernest King, as he came up the ranks, sort of committed himself to improving the role of education in the professional ranks of the United States Navy. That is reflected in the reforms that he championed in the famous 1919 Knox-Pye-King report. And of course, Admiral Sims and Henry T. Mayo were both sort of involved with that effort as well. So they provided top cover for the junior officers as they took on the Navy Department and challenged the, as they called them, salt horses of the day to crack a book and actually learn something so they can speak intelligently about strategic affairs as opposed to just focusing on the tactical execution.
Let's turn back to that in the context of what King had already done, because he'd served in the Spanish-American War as a mid. He had commanded a destroyer, and that was during the occupation of Veracruz. And what,
two destroyers. Yep.
And he had served on the staff of Admiral Mayo during the First World War. And then he goes on to the Naval Postgraduate School. Are those what influence him with the Knox-Pie-King report?
The Knox-Pie-King report, there's a long story to how that report happened. I wrote a little bit of that story in my article called Charting a New Course about how the Knox-Pie-King report was done. I would say that it's a long chronology that gets you to 1919. A lot of it is influenced by King's personal experiences, which, you know, are punctuated by his experiences not only on the staffs of Admiral Osterhaus and Commodore Sims before the First World War, but of course during the First World War, he became what everybody called him, the boy captain, because he was 38 years old when he made temporary appointment as a captain. And
when he's commanding a ship.
Right.
Let's see, he graduated in 1901, so 13 years, that would have made him, what, 35 commanding his first ship?
So he took the Terry in 1913 after he completed service at the experimentation school under Admiral Kincaid, who's Thomas Kincaid's father. So there's a connection there between the Kincaids and the King story, and later on that unfolds during the Battle of Lady Gulf. So there's those connections, those personal connections. But his service on board Terry, as you mentioned earlier, was punctuated by his experience during the so-called Grape Juice War, the Veracruz expedition. And, of course, Henry T. Mayo was the commodore in command down there. During that service, by the way, King conducted an experimental underway replenishment with a ship called the Arethusa. It was a stationary replenishment. Through those sort of early experiments, the U.S. Navy did develop underway replenishment doctrine, and King also had a hand in that. We can talk about that perhaps separately in another part of the discussion. The Terry was his first actual command where he was on his own, and I think he learned a lot about convoy coordination, about expeditionary operations, offshore gunnery. Even though the expedition to Veracruz is sort of obscure in popular memory, there's a lot that went on at Veracruz that I think was very formative to King and his generation.
Such as?
Well, so, you know, expeditionary operations ashore in a war that's essentially undeclared. You got Patrick Bellinger flying the first combat mission and actually taking fire from the ground, flying a naval aircraft above the scene of battle. Of course, Captain Douglas MacArthur's running around the whole situation as well. So there's a lot going on at Veracruz that I think historians should, you know, look at and discover some of the things that you could apply to why people were acting the way they were acting in other subsequent conflicts.
So with regard to convoys and what he learned during Veracruz, he must have brought that when he worked on the staff during World War One, when he was based in the UK. Is that right?
Technically, he was based on the flagship of the Atlantic Fleet, which was the Pennsylvania. But Henry T. Mayo, as the admiral in command of the Atlantic Fleet, did send Ernest King over to London to serve as his liaison to Admiral Sims during the First World War. Getting those convoys across was a complicated story and very sort of convoluted. There's a lot of personalities involved. Sims would have you believe that he was in command of the whole convoy operations, but Admiral Gleaves would take task to that assertion, and Ernest King would probably say, well, Henry T. Mayo is ultimately in command of the whole thing. That's a complicated history. It's probably more than we can get into in this particular format. But
does that play out in later decades, Dave? And how King will deal with other senior officers, and how he's viewing three of his senior officers, three admirals, argue over their own rice bowl, or actually the same rice bowl that they're fighting over.
Well, that's there's the lesson right there that King sort of draws from all that. When we get into the Second World War context, and there's fights ongoing between the British and the Americans about the right way of conducting the Atlantic War, for example. King would always hearken back to the First World War mayhem that took place. And really, it was during the First World War is when King is really first exposed to multinational command organizations, the dynamics of personality, the role of intelligence from wireless communication sources. And I think he's learning a lot of important lessons in that experience. Among other things that I would say that's coming out in my forthcoming book, Ernest King was very close personal friends with Captain Dudley Pound, who later became the first Sea Lord in the Second World War. And that personal relationship continued into the interwar period, where Pound and King were trading Christmas cards with each other. So there is a myth out there that King is an Anglophobe. In fact, what I've found in my research is that King had a great affinity for the Royal Navy and its traditions. It's just that King had a job to do in the Second World War, and he did it quite well.
Now, there's a story that King would wear the breast pocket handkerchief under his ribbons because of Admiral David Beatty. Is that a true story, or is that more apocryphal?
The handkerchief is actually something that he just kind of picked up on his own. However, there is a picture of David Beatty, and he's standing with his hand in his pocket, and his cap is sort of cocked back, and Beatty's looking exceedingly confident, just as Beatty used to do, you know. Ernest King used that same pose in his official pictures. And Dudley Knox, when he wrote to Walter Muir Whitehill about this picture that King had, where he had his hand in his pocket and his hat is slightly cocked back at a jaunty angle, and he's got his handkerchief, you know, very gallant 19th century gentleman type of thing. Dudley Knox said, well, that's Ernie doing his Beatty. And that's how Dudley Knox characterized it. King was emulating the image of confidence in that particular picture, as demonstrated by Beatty. The origin to that story, by the way, starts in the Grand Fleet maneuvers of 1918. By 1918, you had Battleship Division 9, which was operating as the 6th Battle Squadron under Hugh Rodman, that fell under the Grand Fleet of the Royal Navy under Beatty. And during the Grand Fleet maneuvers of 1918, Royal Navy Admiral Sturdee surprised Beatty coming out of the mist and actually crossed the T of the Grand Fleet and completely humiliated Beatty in the context of the Grand Fleet maneuvers. And apparently Beatty just responded by saying, "Excellent! Great, great exercise. Wonderful. Good job." And then he walked off the bridge. And King was sort of chuckling about it. And he said to William S. Pye, he said, "Now that's how you lose."
So after the First World War, he's at the Naval Postgraduate School. And we mentioned Knox and Pye. Real quickly, who were Knox and Pye?
William S. Pye is a classmate of King's at the Naval Academy. And they were very close friends their entire careers. Dudley Knox was a little bit senior to them, class of 1897, and Knox he's senior, but at the same time, you know, they're running in the same circles. Knox is a very learned historian. He's self-taught, a historian in the first rate, in every way.
Oh, sure. So his works are still standard text today for naval historians.
Yeah, as Franklin Roosevelt later wrote, Knox's single volume history of the U.S. Navy is the best ever printed. Dudley Knox, once I put King to bed, I do intend to go back and work on Knox, because there's so much more to say about how Dudley Knox mobilized history as a strategic asset of the United States Navy.
And I should point out here, Dave, that you did do a book called, you edited a book called 21st Century Knox, and that's part of Commander B.J. Armstrong's series on the 21st Century series.
I'm glad you said that, Claude, because I couldn't have said it any better.
All right, so tell me about NPS. The reason why they do this report, I want to know, was it the three officers who were getting together over a couple of beers and saying, hey, we ought to write this report, or were they being directed to by somebody more senior at the Naval Postgraduate School? How did it originate?
So the Naval War College and the Naval Postgraduate School were both closed during the First World War. They did not hold classes. And Josephus Daniels was
Secretary of the Navy.
Correct. Secretary of the Navy, Josephus Daniels, wanted to consolidate the war colleges in the Washington area, which is all part of the Army-Navy rivalry, the unification debate, the whole that all that. And so Sims stood up against that whole concept and basically argued that we should decommission warships in order to pay for the restoration of the War College and the Naval Postgraduate School. So there was a big fight between Sims and Daniels. King is junior. He's a captain, but his permanent rank at the time was as a commander. And so King's trying to find a place to go at the end of the First World War. And Henry T. Mayo and William S. Sims sort of compared notes, and both of them agreed that education was absolutely crucial to the future of the United States Navy, particularly given the lessons that they had learned while serving with the Royal Navy in European waters. Among other figures of interest who influenced American thinking is Sir Julian Corbett, who ran the historical section of the Imperial War Staff. And Julian Corbett influenced Sims to create a historical section at the U.S. Naval War College under Dudley Knox in 1919. So it's part of that whole milieu where Dudley Knox and Sims are creating a historical section up at the War College to replicate what they had seen at the Admiralty and in London during the First World War. Meanwhile, King is reverting in rank to the rank of commander, and the postgraduate school was just a billet that was open for him to fill while he was awaiting future assignment. But he dived into that billet with both feet, typical of Ernest King, and he said, look, we're going to create the postgraduate school as sort of a preparatory course for those of you who want to be communication specialists, engineers, naval architects. You're going to be a lieutenant. You're going to come to the Naval Postgraduate School, and we're going to teach you how to spell. And then we're not going to give you a degree. We're just going to send you off to Harvard or Columbia or, University of Iowa, whatever, where you get a real legitimate graduate degree. The postgraduate school was designed to prepare lieutenants to go off to get those higher degrees. So there was no production of degrees within the Navy. It was a situation where we were trying to prepare you to go to a civilian university to get the terminal degree.
Is there any indication from his letters, which you've gone through, you've gone through them forward, backward, up and down. So now you have the Naval Academy, which is created and established in 1845. You have the Naval War College that is established just a few years before King is completing his degree at the Naval Academy. And now he's proposing that he expands this Naval Postgraduate School. Did he think about consolidating any of these? Did he see there was any crossover?
He saw them as having different functions. He would have taken the education for sea power concept, the Naval University system. He would have taken that to task. Ernest King would have said that's a big waste of taxpayer money. He envisioned the Naval Postgraduate School to serve as a preparatory school to send naval practitioners off to places like Harvard and Columbia, not actually try and produce degrees within the service, but actually send you where the degrees are already established and where you could work with the greatest minds in the field of specialization that you're working in. And a lot of those guys ended up staying in the service. You know, if you look at the Naval Register, there are there are naval officers with PhDs from Harvard and Yale and Columbia and other places who went through the postgraduate school under King. And that's an important point, I think, when we think about
that. That was not detrimental to their careers back then, was it? Because you see very few PhDs normally on active duty. You have the professional military professors at the academy, but you don't normally see somebody who's gone off to get a PhD and then returned to the fleet and risen to flag rank. Is that correct?
So there's a difference in the culture of the service of a century ago from what we have today. You know, today it's the up and out. You know, I don't know why, but the Navy made me into a commander before I finally retired. Back then, you could have been a lieutenant for your entire career, and it would have been all right. If you wanted to specialize in cryptography, like Lawrence Safford did, he was a lieutenant commander in 1924. Before World War II, he was a lieutenant commander. But he was really good at cryptography, and that's what he wanted to do. You could do that in that Navy. You could specialize. I mean, there was a consequence. If you didn't get back to sea in a timely manner, you would have been sort of held in a certain place rank-wise, but it wasn't about rank back then. It was about duty. I would say that we have lost, in today's age, the sense of reverence and duty that they had. So it wasn't about rank. It wasn't even about pay. It was about the privilege of being able to serve in the ranks of the Navy. And a lot of these guys dedicated themselves entirely to the service. I always love the quote from Henry Stimson, who said that any of his dealings with the Navy Department of Ernest King during the Second World War, naval officers would fade into this dim world in which Neptune was God, Mahan his prophet, and the Navy the only true church. I find that quote to be interesting because it illustrates the level of dedication that I think the naval officers of that period exhibited on a regular basis in their careers.
What's the direct impact of the Knox-Pyke-King report?
So the Knox-Pyke-King report was very controversial at the time because it required naval officers to go back to school at least twice in their progression up the ranks to higher command. And the Navy, typical of the Navy, said, we can't afford to do that. And so Admiral Washington, who was part of this discussion, basically got the report and said, thank you, this is a wonderful report. And then that ended up in the circular filing cabinet, and nobody was going to do anything about it. Ernest King, at the time, was the editor of the Naval Institute Proceedings, and in August of 1920, for some reason, the text of the Knox-Pyke-King report ended up in the Naval Institute Proceedings of August of 1920. And when asked, King said, I don't know how it got in there. One of the interesting things that I found in the folder at the Library of Congress, the folder that deals with King's funeral, contains the original signed Knox-Pyke-King report. And when I found it, it was odd because I was going through all these funeral planning records. There's this document just sort of in the file, and I'm like, well, this document doesn't seem to mix with the other ones, you know, because it had faded into that nice sepia color that documents fade into. And I was like, what? And I'm reading it, and I realized what it was. And the original signatures of Knox, Pye, and King are on that document in the Library of Congress. It's a real treasure.
In the 20s, I think is he a SWO, a submariner, and a naval aviator all in the same decade?
Ernie King would tell you that he was a line officer first and foremost, and any specialized qualification that he received would have been a specialized qualification that he had, but he was a naval officer in all respects. And to his credit, really, he sought the opportunities to go into other branches of the service and get those qualifications. I would hasten to remind people that Ernie King was also qualified in wireless communications. His ship, the Terry, was one of the earliest ships equipped with wireless technology, and he also worked with a guy named Chester Nimitz during the 1912 wireless communication tests, where they used a wireless set to send an electronic communication from a submarine to an air to a surface ship, and from a surface ship to an aircraft. There's a lot of interesting characters involved with that. When I discovered that little piece of it, I found it really interesting that a lot of these associations with people really begin early on the careers of these guys. You know, Ernest King knew Chester Nimitz as early as 1906, and that relationship continued all the way through their careers.
What does he learn as the commanding officer of the USS Lexington, the carrier?
Yeah, that's a great question. During that period, the aircraft carrier program was in its infancy. Admiral Moffett was trying to figure out how to deal with the Billy Mitchell argument about strategic air power. And one of the things about Admiral Moffett is that he envisioned Zeppelin technology as being the future of the Navy. You know, so there's these real Buck Rogers sort of designs of Zeppelins, you know, where airplanes actually fly out of the Zeppelin and everything else. The Akron, for example, is an airship that King himself flew on at one point. And King decided, you know, this is a nice little interesting novelty, but it's not the future of the U.S. Navy in terms of aviation or air power for that matter. And so King and Moffett really sort of came at odds with each other. At the same time, Moffett had a great deal of respect for King. So King did qualify as an aviator at the ripe old age of 49 years old, and he did command the Lexington starting in 1930, actually, he took command. And during that period, he did all the things that the U.S. Navy did ultimately in the Second World War. He experimented with carrier tactics. He did the hot refueling tactics and shifting of ordnance. You know, he developed procedures to do that within the context of a fleet that was really oriented towards the battleship. And so one of the great things about King's time on the Lexington, there's another guy who was serving on board at the time named Robert Heinlein, who graduated from the Naval Academy and was actually the communications officer on board the Lexington. And the ship's newspaper was called The Observer. And Robert Heinlein submitted a story that he'd written up, you know, just a funny little story to entertain the crewmen of the Lexington. And the story talked about a detective who was trying to chase down a murder. And the detective discovered that an alien had committed the murder. And that was the first Robert Heinlein science fiction story that was published. And, of course, the editor was Ernest J. King. And later on, Robert Heinlein became pretty important to the field of science fiction. And one of the great things about the King story that I've discovered through the family is that Robert Heinlein was actually very close to the family. He actually dated one of King's daughters. After the Second World War, Heinlein wanted to write about his experience during the Second World War. He was a civilian, actually, by that point. He couldn't really write about it without fictionalizing. So Heinlein science fictionalized his efforts during the Second World War to develop what we call the Combat Information Center. In his science fictional description of the Combat Information Center, he put it on a spaceship. He basically described what a CIC would do, but at the time it was classified, but he got away with it by science fictionalizing it. And I can tell you that the book is actually dedicated to Jimmy Smith, who was the grandson of Ernest J. King. Interestingly, the main character, the captain character in that book, is also based upon the example that Heinlein witnessed as Captain Ernest J. King. And later on, of course, Gene Roddenberry read that story and thought he could do better. And so Gene Roddenberry created the character known as Captain Kirk and the USS Enterprise and all that stuff. So I don't know. Arguably, Ernest King could be the great-great-great-granddad of Captain, the future Captain James T. Kirk.
Doesn't King also, when he's commanding officer of the Lexington, work on Yarnell's fleet problems as well?
Yeah,
so the attack on Pearl Harbor.
So that's King's idea as well. He and Harry Yarnell, who happens to also be a fellow Iowan like I am, came up with the idea of demonstrating the vulnerability in closed harbors to aircraft carrier attack. Harry Yarnell, of course, was a qualified naval observer, so he had an affinity for the potential of aviation, and he allowed King to sort of develop the idea. And sure enough, in 1932, King bombed Pearl Harbor in a simulated attack. He did it again later on, 1938, during the joint exercises of 38, which were later covered in the Saturday Evening Post of January 1939 in an article written by Stephen Eureka. Stephen Eureka, of course, was the air operations officer on board the Hornet during the Doolittle raid. So this is all kind of interesting stuff. I always enjoy telling people that Ernie King bombed Pearl Harbor twice before Yamamoto ever did.
All right, so that begs the question. Why did the Navy not strengthen Pearl Harbor once they saw the vulnerabilities from not one but two simulated attacks by U.S. carriers?
Well, so that's the whole question about Joe Richardson's stance against the decision to send the fleet out to Pearl Harbor. Joe Richardson was perfectly correct in arguing that there weren't enough facilities to accommodate the sailors, and the oil bunkerage in Pearl Harbor was not sufficient to allow the Navy to maintain sustain operations from that particular anchorage at the time. Joe Richardson, of course, failed to understand the grander strategic objective of moving the fleet to Pearl Harbor within the context early Anglo-American efforts to position against vis-a-vis, you know, Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. And of course, Imperial Japan, that whole negotiation was ongoing, and the objective in moving the battle fleet to Pearl Harbor was to send a message to Japan that any offensive actions against Singapore and the Philippines would be met. So it was a real chess game that was going on. And even though Joe Richardson's particular points were correct, Joe Richardson failed to see the forest through the trees. And King actually said that it was quite correct to remove Joe Richardson as the what they called the SINCUS back then, Commander-in-Chief U.S. Fleet. So the issue with Pearl Harbor was it truly was a surprise attack. Nobody considered it really feasible for Japan to get almost 4,000 nautical miles undetected and be able to launch the type of attack that they were able to do in the end. Ernie King knew personally how difficult that type of an attack would be to pull off, especially from the standpoint of maintaining operational security and surprise. And if anything, Ernest King would certainly give some amount of respect to the planners who implemented that attack and were able to keep it completely surprise. Now, the other thing I would say about this is that the intelligence was not as clear as people like to think it is. War Department and Navy Department and State Department failed to share information in such a way that the president and other senior leaders could make appropriate decisions about the positioning of American forces in anticipation of Pearl Harbor. The other thing about this is that the Joint Army-Navy issues for the Second World War, which actually remain unresolved during the Second World War, were also a factor in that under the joint relationship between War Department and Navy Department, the Army actually had the responsibility for protecting the fleet when it was in harbor. The Army Air Corps, which then became the Army Air Force, actually had the responsibility for long-range reconnaissance, which of course they weren't doing. So it was Ernest King's position that Betty Stark shouldn't be punished, but George Marshall should be, and Hap Arnold should have been fired after Pearl Harbor. But of course, that's another debate altogether.
Let's turn the time back just a few years. After the 1932 fleet exercise, he goes off to the Naval War College. What did you learn about his time at the Naval War College in 32, 33, 34 maybe?
Yeah, so King had completed command in the Lexington. He was tracking to be an admiral. Of course, at the time, there were very few billets available, so the War College provided a place for people like King to go while the Bureau of Navigation figured out how to promote the guy. He did promote early to flag rank, which is an important point. While he was at the Naval War College, he and Harris Lanning, you know, basically talked about how to use aircraft carriers in the future, and of course, his experience bombing Pearl Harbor in the simulated exercise loomed large in his analysis of how to use aircraft carriers in the wargaming floors of the Naval War College. Of course, you got Raymond Spruance there on the faculty. You have Adolphus Andrews, who is also there, battleship guy. You have Alan Goodrich Kirk, Richmond Kelly Turner. They're all sort of there together with King in Newport figuring out how to use aircraft carriers. One thing I always like to point out about the role of the Naval War College is Ernie King put his money where his mouth was. He graduated from the War College three times in his career. First time he completed the staff course in 1916, which qualified him for assignment to the Atlantic Fleet during World War I. And then in 1924, while he was in command of the submarine flotilla in New London, he completed the graduate curriculum of the Naval War College in 1924. And then again, he came back to the college and graduated in 1933 when he made rank as an admiral after Moffett had crashed on the Akron. That's another story altogether, which I can talk about if you like.
I think we will, but we're going to do it in part two, which covers Fleet Admiral Ernest J. King during the war. How's that?
Okay.
All right. Commander David Conan, PhD, Director Hattendorf Historical Center at the Naval War College. Dave, thanks for your time today and look forward to part two.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.